Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And our icebreaker question was inspired by all the latest breach announcements, and I wanted to know, which breach do you think is worse? When Yahoo admitted that all 3 billion accounts were breached, or the Equifax breach that impacted over 145 million Americans?
Hey, this is Mike Thompson, and I think the Equifax breach is worse. I mean, this is just, I guess, maybe my personal thoughts. I consider it worse for me. I'm sure my information was compromised. All of us were. And, you know, any American that's had a credit check, there's so much sensitive information that they have about us and our preferences and our finances. Obviously, 3 billion Yahoo accounts sounds like a huge number, but I don't know how valuable any of that information was. Like, I have a Yahoo account that the only reason it exists is because I once played fantasy football on Yahoo. So not to say that there isn't a big problem with that breach, but to me, the Equifax one is the one that has the biggest implications for most people.
Hi, this is Killian. Like, I think the Equifax is definitely the worst breach simply because of the quality of the information, the type of the information, or at least it's the most directly impactful. So security numbers, all of your other personal information is incredibly damaging in the near term and forever, potentially, because social security numbers, unless the government acts like they claim they might and get rid of them, are with you forever. And I think the Yahoo breach, and they've just, I mean, dropped the ball in every possible way. But I don't know all the details of what exactly was leaked, but going from the previous ones, it's, you know, email addresses, passwords, things like that. In the long run, that could have a lot of secondary damage. If people reuse passwords that were leaked, it could lead to secondary implications. But I feel like that is less directly impactful, at least in the long run.
This is Mike Buckby, and I don't know which is the worst, but between Mike Thompson talking about fantasy football and then talking really about, you know, the number of people involved and then what's been leaked in each of one of these breaches, it makes me think we could come up with a nice like spreadsheet formula for this, where we could like, you know, put a score on it and then see which one did better. And then, you know, whoever won at the end of the season would owe everyone else like a case of beer.
Fantasy security.
Fantasy data breach.
Well, why a case of beer? Just give them free credit monitoring like everybody else does.
You get a case of beer with your social security number on the outside of it, plainly labeled for everyone to see.
Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit veronis.com/review. So on to today's show. It's often usually during or after a breach that an organization asks how it happened and who the players were. And on this show, we often talk about stories on a case-by-case basis. For instance, when someone accidentally clicks on an email, got tricked into doing so, got someone's credentials, and then somehow it snowballs into a breach story, and then we hear about the news a few months or a few years later. And then it's only recently that I've seen a report on how cybercrime is organized, their methodologies, and how they monetize their activities. And it was created by the National Cybersecurity Center in London. And let's start with how the organization is set up and identify all the players. There's a team leader who is like the CEO, a malware developer, someone who writes and updates new code, network admin or a bot hoarder. They're responsible for hijacking servers and devices, an intrusion specialist that installs malware on a network, a data miner, someone who cleans and organizes the data, and a money specialist, someone who figures out how to monetize the data set that they exfiltrated. And when you read the list, was there a role that surprised you in terms of their job description, or one you thought that would have been there but didn't make it on the list? Or maybe you even got in touch with your dark side and thought, I could probably do this.
I think it's interesting to think of these criminal organizations as having such a traditional structure. I mean, I think what people and you know, popular media certainly perpetuates this, but you think of hacking and you think of some guy in a dark basement somewhere, a lone wolf, or maybe like some, you know, team of hackers like Mr. Robot or something like that. But really, I mean, everyone's got a role. There's a lot of organization here. especially when you look at very successful attacks. And sometimes they're, you know, state-funded groups as well. So there's a lot of resources and a lot of, you know, true organization from the top down to enable these wide-scale attacks. And that's not to say everyone operates this way. I was thinking about what Mike Buckby has kind of talked about in the past with unsuccessful ransomware attacks, you know, not Petya and stuff, where it looks like it's supposed to be ransomware, but maybe it was not. It was supposed to do something else. And, you know, maybe that's just incompetence rather than some disguised ransomware attack. They just didn't do a very good job of developing that malware. So, yeah, I guess I'm not too surprised. It's interesting to see it all broken down like this and say, okay, here's all these individual roles. I think what really kind of blew my mind was all the tools just about how to monetize this, you know? You in the various ways you could do that and some automated ways. And personally, I'm not someone who's really poked around the dark web to see what this stuff looks like. I know certain people have, just to kind of see, you know, how widespread this is. But that's what jumped out to me. It was just kind of like the various ways and methods for monetizing these hacks. And sometimes it, like, the profit margins are slim. You know, they put in all this work and it might not be data that's easily sold or can't be sold for a lot of money.
Well, I just, while Mike was talking, I put on my hacker hoodie because maybe I'm going to interview for a job on one of these crews. What I kind of found the most interesting is just how boring it was. It's set up like any other small startup. You get a bunch of people together with a little mission and you kind of form your team. There's no magic to it. A bunch of people with a common goal. You know, if they put their powers together for good, maybe they could accomplish something beneficial. But in a lot of ways, like the paper mentioned, the barrier to entry is so low that as long as you have a little bit of moral flexibility, let's go with, it's easy to break into the market and at least turn some type of profit. I'm actually kind of surprised they talked about it as much as they did in terms of forming the little crew together, because what we've seen with some of the other kind of malware, ransomware as a service, it's even easier to monetize this without having to go through the effort of finding or creating code, you know, wrangling the botnet. You can basically rent these things as a service anymore from individuals if you're not happy with somebody or you want to make a quick buck.
I just want to mention a few things. One, Killian wasn't joking. He actually, we're on video chat, he did actually put his hoodie up. Next, I think it's important that you always dress for the hacking job you want, not the one you have now. And don't be too literal about it, you know, you don't have to wear a pure black hat. It could be dark gray. It could be, you know, red. It's a different company, but yeah.
Were you scared when Killian put his hoodie on?
I thought he was going to do like an Eminem rap style battle about his mom's spaghetti, but it didn't quite go that way. I kind of, if there's a bone I have to pick with this whole report, it's that it makes it sound, I think, more organized than it actually is. I'm sure it is in some cases. If it's like any other organization of people that's ever existed, it's all crazy chaotic, where I doubt it's this clean. If there's a thing to be concerned about, I think it is that, you know, reading through like all these roles, I think these are honestly roles that almost anyone on this call, most of the people who work at Varonis, competent technical people, could pull off, but they could very easily do these things. You know, what's the difference between, you know, a data scientist who's going through analytics or looking through log files and one that's going through a breach data set and, you know, making it into a slightly better format? I think it's, in a lot of ways, collapsing. It's getting easier and easier to do these things and easier for one person to just, you know, run all of this up.
I had the same thought too. I was like, actually one person can do, or even one or two people can do a whole lot of harm. There was a role that it wasn't listed, but it was shown on an infographic. They called them money mules. And money mules are like freelancers, and they get enlisted with job titles like payment processing agents, money transfer agents, local processors. And when they're applying or doing the job, they're not aware that they're being used to commit fraud. So if you're an unfortunate participant and you get in big trouble with law enforcement, they might freeze your bank account and you might be prosecuted. You might have to repay for all the losses. And then it might also be on your record. And the money mules, they sort of remind me of those that get infected with ransomware, and then they decide to pay the attacker, but then it becomes clear later to law enforcement that you accidentally paid off a terrorist. And the common thread between money mules and someone who got infected with ransomware and paid them off is that these attackers, they prey on vulnerable individuals. And I just found that really fascinating. phishing, it's still a preferred method to get into people's systems. And I loved how Swift on Security shared her workflow to counter phishing attacks. And she profiles the phish strategies, creates rules to audit them. And if the email address is invalid, she takes it. Was there something in the tweet thread you found really fascinating or just really clever?
I think almost the opposite. I think, you know, so many of the phishing scams we think of as, oh, this is very sophisticated and they're like pretending to be someone else. And I think most of them are just at a passing glance bad, that, you know, it'd be so easy to pick out that, oh, this is wrong, this is crazy. But, you know, it reminds me of how like the 419 scammers, the people like, oh, I'm a Nigerian prince, those, they deliberately put bad things in them, like obvious tells that it's a scam, just to like weed out the people that are paying attention. And so the only people that get through the next step are the ones that are pre-qualified as credulous. No one's phishing trying to fool Swift on Security. They're trying to, you know, fool the new intern who just got hired and doesn't know any better. They're trying to fool the person that's not great with computers. And I try to keep that in mind in terms of thinking of like how to counter this.
I mean, I think this is a pretty smart approach if you know that the users you're responsible for are maybe a good target. I mean, in my previous role, I certainly had some customers who fell prey to phishing attacks. And, you know, when we saw the emails that they fell for, I was like absolute facepalm. I couldn't believe that they could fall for it. But then I've also seen ones that were pretty well crafted. So if it's affected a company whatsoever, if you've had users fall prey to phishing attacks, you know, this isn't necessarily that much work. It's a pretty good methodology to limit the impact of these phishing scams. So it's going to be pretty obvious the people should be able to avoid this stuff, especially this day and age when it's been so prevalent for years now. But if it's a problem for your company, why not put a couple extra processes in place to eliminate that threat as much as possible?
In terms of putting the processes, I mean, anything you can do to eliminate it or reduce it is probably going to be beneficial, but it's just a strictly a numbers game. If you send out enough of these, you're going to catch somebody who's not paying attention. They're hurried. And as Mike said, you know, they might be a little bit pre-qualified at that point, but again, it's strictly a numbers game, and it's almost like just general spam. It's almost an arms race at this point, just to simply try and keep up with the number of variations that are coming out. So there's no foolproof method, even trying to educate people. Everybody has one of those days where they're not paying attention. You know, the dog's barking, the kid's crying, your work phone's blowing up if you're at home. So, you know, people can fall victim, even though they might be, we might put all defenses in place and educate them as much as possible, but certainly never hurts to try.
There was another Twitter thread that got everyone involved when the former Equifax CEO said that it was an IT person's fault, and it got a bunch of other replies and thousands of retweets and likes. And we often talk a lot about the tension between IT and C-level and executives and how they're not on the same page, not speaking the same language. What is a productive lesson here on both sides?
So a community that I'm involved in a lot with is sort of the DevOps community. DevOps is really about processes. This is about changing how admin works to sort of break down some of the walls that occur and to make it so that the understanding and the sense of responsibility is spread out, so you can have more resilient architecture, so you can deploy your code more often, so you can be more secure. And a really key part of that is what they call blameless postmortems. And I think you see this a lot more at companies that have really adopted this. So in contrast to Equifax, if you look at something like Amazon, Amazon had a horrible S3 outage a couple months ago. And it really came down to, there was one person who ran a series of commands that were in the playbook of what they were supposed to do. But what happened was that they had, you know, a whole bunch of different things go on. And it ended up that it took down a large chunk of S3, which the entire internet depends upon. And there was no talk of, oh, it was this person's fault. It was, everything was around, oh, our processes were wrong. Oh, our tooling was wrong. Our approach to this was wrong. And out of that, it's very clear to see that, well, this happened before, it's not going to happen again. And there's, you know, this sense of learning and taking away from it. This gives me very little confidence that this is happening inside of Equifax.
Yeah, something that jumped out to me was they were talking about this person's job security, whoever this person to be blamed is, which is just absurd. The solution to this problem is not, oh, we fired that person, no worries, they won't make that mistake again. The solution is, you know, fixing the processes. So I think it's very convenient to be able to point the finger at one person, and that might be true. It really might be one person's fault. That's not out of the realm of possibility, but it should be. You know, it should be out of the realm of possibility, because nothing should be one person's fault. So it really speaks to kind of mismanagement from the top down, if it even got to the place where one person's mistake could lead to something this severe.
Being, and I think we can probably speak for a lot of people in IT and security, having, you know, the CEO go up there and blame, you know, Johnson and the IT dungeon for this horrible foul up is, it's almost infuriating. As both Mike's kind of mentioned, it can't possibly come down to one person, you know, missed an email and forgot to push out a patch. If they don't have the systems in place to verify and validate this, if they haven't thought about, you know, a patch management process, or if that process failed, or if they're not performing vulnerability scans, there should be dozens of places and dozens of individuals within the company all up and down who had to have had a voice or should have had a voice in terms of building this process out. And if they never had those conversations, if it never came up, they're all completely derelict in their duty, and they're all responsible, the entire chain of command. Because somebody somewhere should have said something. Hey, our patch management process isn't working. We don't have feedback. We're not tracking this. It's not just one dude who, you know, missed his email or forgot to push out the patch to the system. It can't possibly be. There has to be. There's a chain of command for a reason. There are other people involved in the process for a reason. And if they can't kind of get that together, everybody from that poor guy's boss all the way up to the CEO is 100% responsible. There are too many points in this chain to have it be the last guy in the bottom who's going to take the blame for this.
We're at a point where the ramifications of building all the different technologies and moving quickly and getting things done from a tech side, that it's finally the pros and cons of what technology can bring, the good and the bad, it's starting to catch up with us. That's part of the reason why maybe we're noticing all these breaches all of a sudden, because for a short while, like, people didn't know what data security was. It was only in the past couple of years that we're almost seeing it every week that something got breached. Now with the iPhone X that's going to come out, and with the ability to authenticate with our face, it might be fun to play with the idea. What new roles do you think cyber criminals are developing or thinking about?
This maybe sounds too much like a sommelier, like I'm trying to pair things together, like, oh, this red goes with this steak. But I feel like the phishing really goes well with the iPhone face detection, in the same way that, you know, there's no technology that you can do that, if you trick the person into who's legitimately supposed to do it into getting around it, it won't keep you secure. And this is just one more piece of that, you know, if you trick someone who has a secure password into entering it in because they think they need to, well, you've tricked them. Now you're in the system, and it doesn't matter that passwords, you know, be encrypted in the database and encrypted at rest and, you know, is sufficiently complex and everything else. It's still bypassed. And I think that's going to be the real piece of this, is that, you know, it's going to be bypassed for where it counts, by the same way, by tricking people, by phishing them, by, you know, spoofing them into doing something they shouldn't be doing.
I don't know if this is, you know, building a better mousetrap for any reason. I don't know if the face recognition is going to provide a sufficiently better layer of security, just because of what Mike said. It almost doesn't matter. It sounds more like a gimmick or something that you'd see in a Mission Impossible movie, as opposed to something that's going to really affect security in any meaningful way. But
well, then what's the point of creating a biometric to scan our face and authenticate than with our fingerprint?
Because Apple needs to sell, you know, another 10 million of these ridiculous phones. That's why.
Do you think that's the only reason?
Yes.
I don't think so. I think this could actually be good for security, because I think everyone would use this. I mean, if security is transparent, all the people that are not using passcodes and fingerprints and everything else now because they pick up their phone 100 times a day and it's an extra, you know, second or two every time they do. If this makes it so more people use that, that seems good. There is a deep relationship between the user experience and security. And the easier and by default things are secure, the more they're used and the better we are, you know, sort of as a herd immunity to the stuff. I guess my point was just that there's no magic, you know, cream that makes everything secure when you work it into the server. You know, it's not, there's no magic here. There's only improvement. And this could definitely be an improvement. So Killian's wrong is what I'm saying.
We'll come back and talk about this later, Mike.
There's a dark alley outside the Verona's headquarters. And as I walk by, Killian in his hoodie steps out and grabs me from behind.
Then I get your face.
Then he scans my face and runs off with my phone. That's
yep.
Perfect. The perfect run.
Dun, dun, dun.
I think you guys are right on that. It's really just a matter of convenience. I mean, Apple claims it's a lot more secure than the Touch ID, the fingerprint identification. I'm sure, like, I think my parents probably either don't have a passcode on their phone or use 1234 or something silly like that, just because it's an inconvenience for them. So if it's something you don't even think about, you pick up your phone, raise to wake, it looks at your face, it unlocks. You know, that's pretty painless, and I think it's pretty secure. Maybe not as secure as a long passcode would be, but I think the wider spread this becomes, the better for everyone. The question is everyone going to do it responsibly? I talk a lot about how Apple handles their security, doing a lot of stuff on device as opposed to passing it up to the cloud. You know, the differences between like the way Siri functions versus something like Amazon Echo, for example. So I have a lot of faith in kind of the way they're executing this. But if we see more and more devices start to implement this because it just becomes like really easy to produce, I don't have confidence that every tech company is going to do this kind of biometric scanning with the same level of security. So I think right now it's going to be on a small scale. That iPhone X is going to be very hard to get your hands on. It's going to be very limited. And people absolutely should try and poke holes in this. I don't think if holes are going to be found now, I think holes will be found in a couple of years when this technology is used irresponsibly by a lot more players.
Something interesting to think about is there was a really great article about how that bar, the notch in the iPhone X, is essentially the miniaturized version of the Kinect from the Xboxes. And if you remember that, it was a big bar. It looked like, you know, the size of like a really chunky TV remote or something. And now it's this tiny inch wide set of sensors that's in a phone and you just carry around with you. And I just kind of think about, well, in 10 years from now, it'll be the size of, you know, a grain of rice, and it will have all the same capabilities of, you know, the IR grid and the facial recognition. And these will just be thrown out in the street and take everyone's picture and everyone's facial, you know, geometry and use it to get into all sorts of stuff. Everything keeps evolving.
There was a point about Instagram and Facebook and using that as a way to bypass security, and makes me wonder, like, in the future, if our faces become a value in some degree as our identity, if there's an Instagram breach or if there's a Facebook breach or some kind of breach that's aligned with our biometrics rather than our social security numbers, that would be kind of scary, getting into paranoid mode. But hey, Mike, we have a tool of the week?
Yes. So we're talking about phishing. And one very large vector for phishing is when emails pretend to come from within your organization, so that you think it's something from the accounting department where they're asking you about an invoice, but really it's from outside the company, or it's an emergency, you know, email from the CEO asking you for some data, and it's not actually from the CEO. And a good way to counter this is with a DNS record called SPF, Sender Policy Framework. And it's really just a list of what email server IP addresses and domains are allowed to send email on behalf of your network. And we have a tool we built called the SPF Translator, which is at veronis.com/SPF_translator, that tells you in very clear terms what your SPF records are for your domain, and more importantly, how to change them to be more secure. A lot of times people don't set these as tightly as they maybe could because they're afraid of actually messing up their emails going out. So this is a great way to set that up prospectively so you can see where you can improve. The SPF Translator.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Killian Engler, and Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.